Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
This episode of Kimberly's Intentional Moment is brought to you by the Seika Network on Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good morning, and good afternoon, good evening, and good night to those people across the world. I am so excited to be with you today and with my teacher, Salvatore Zambito, once again, as we continue our discussion in yoga, or what yoga actually is, and hopefully will help create some discussion and some questions. Remember, you can always contact me at kimtalkradio@gmail.com with any concerns, questions, or further discussion you would like to have about yoga or the practice that we've been discussing for several shows now. Hey, Salvatore, I'm so excited to have you back.
Oh, Kimberly.
How are you?
I always enjoy our conversations, and this is just another chance to talk to you.
I know. This is such a treat for me because I get to have my teacher, my friend, my family discussing things further that we love to discuss anyway. And so I'm just super happy to have you on the show. And this is our second show together. And so I thought what would be a nice way to begin is to just review what is yoga and how do the Yoga Sutras or how does the Yoga Sutra fit into the practice of yoga or yoga?
Kimberly, I think I'm going to start a step back from your question.
Okay.
And talk a little bit, and I don't want to, we could take the whole show to talk about this, but the differences in cultural approaches to reality. And
okay.
This is kind of on the front pages of the newspapers today as we're looking at the various political and military disasters, basically, that are unfolding in the Middle East. And one of the difficulties that we have is understanding that different cultures can approach physical and social reality radically differently, and it can work for them inside their cultural milieu. Part of the difficulty in talking about what is yoga is that Americans and Englishmen and probably Germans and Italians, anybody would tend to project their assumptions about reality on this thing called yoga. And this thing
sure.
called yoga, yeah, well, and why not? I'm not making a criticism here.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what I did in my earliest times with yoga, and we have nothing else to work with except our cultural perspective. The difficulty here, and what
that
I had to overcome, and things that you and I have talked about, has been that to come to understand yoga, I've had to sometimes, over time, come to look at my own assumptions and set them aside and kind of put on another hat, so to speak.
Yeah.
So I'd start out by saying that yoga is a cultural artifact of a society that was, and to some extent still is, very different from the Western world. So yoga is based on a completely different set of assumptions about space, time, matter, and the definition of what a human is. And if people want to go back to the last talk, I talked in the previous interview about the issues of physical reality and the special theory of relativity, E equals MC squared, and how that applied to Indian society in ancient times and how that formed into yoga.
Can you review that in case someone's just listening for the first time?
Sure. Less than 100 years ago, Albert Einstein, published the formula, the special theory of relativity, E equals mc squared, energy equals mass vibrating at the speed of light squared. The inverse of that is matter is energy divided by the speed of light squared. So matter is energy stepped down in vibration by the rate of the speed of light squared. In other words, energy and matter are the same thing along a spectrum of vibration. And this was understood somehow in ancient India and encoded into the language. Now, another language, people see the world radically differently. If we take the substance we call paper, the word for that in Navajo, I have been given to understand that the most literal translation for the Navajo word for paper is energy in the process of papering at this moment in its transition to other energy forms. So somehow the Navajo understood this energy-matter continuum and the vibration at the molecular and atomic level and encoded it into their language. English at that, in that area, is actually somewhat more simplistic and primitive because we have very strong energy-matter separation. The nouns and the verbs are very separated. But if we go into the core language of going back to yoga, the core language here is Sanskrit. And in Sanskrit, then all nouns come from verb roots. So if you speak the language fluently, you know that all physical things are coming from an energetic origin.
Yes, that is very different.
And these are powerful assumptions, Kimberly.
Yeah.
And something that, in order for me to get my students to have a basic understanding of it, to some extent we have to go back to sixth grade physics, but what we're talking about here is that physics concepts that in the West are still at the level, shall we say, of theory and abstraction. During more ancient times in India were visceral and day-to-day functional understandings. Saying that, we have a culture, what we call the Vedic civilization, which is where yoga, as we've come to know it, really came into fruition. And the culture is completely different from anything that we have. It was an integrated culture. And the culture actually had a mission. And the mission was to support people moving into what we might call now higher consciousness. And so it was almost, and I'm oversimplifying, but I'm going to say it anyway to make a point, that it was kind of like a culture dedicated to meditation.
Okay.
It was 5,000 years. The Indian civilization, even as it is now, it's gone through a number of changes, but it's had a written, literary, civilized history, if literacy being part of the definition of civilization. It's 5,000 years old, Kimberly. It's 2.5 times older than Western civilization.
Yeah.
And as I pointed out in the previous interview, it was a culture that was not dedicated to the material world. It was dedicated to the exploration of what we might call the human spirit. So this is the only culture that, or the only society that anthropologists, to the best of my knowledge, unless they found another one, it was the only society that did not invent the wheel. On the eastern side, it took the wheel from Burma, and on the western side, it took the wheel from Persia, but they were involved in other pursuits that were far more cerebral. And it was the Indians who came up with the concept of zero that made modern mathematics possible. It was the Indians who came up with the numerical system that the Arabs adopted, and we adopted from the Arabs. We call it the Arabic numerals, but the Arabs got it from the Indians. They invented chess. The most elaborate music system in the world. They were dealing with something completely different than the material world, and from this society emerged what we call yoga. Now, that society, into the Vedic civilization, because there were also civilizations before the Vedic, but I'm going to just bring it to the Vedic period. Philosophy has always been a way of life in India. If you go to India and actually spend some time there, not just as a tourist, but an actual traveler, you can find yourself having philosophical discussions with rickshaw drivers and fruit sellers and clerks in your hotel. Philosophical discourse seems to be central to the Indian character. And that's whether they're so-called Hindus or Muslims. The entire country is very philosophically inclined. Where this becomes important with yoga is that by the time this book, the Yoga Sutra, which I'll describe in a minute, was written, the philosophical arguments in India had examined every element that we think of in Western philosophy and had examined them to the point of exhaustion 1,000 years before Western civilization even started to emerge. So right now, if you take a survey of philosophy, you'll find over 1,500 schools of Western philosophy, and they continue to argue among themselves. But what happened in the Vedic civilization was that these multitude schools of philosophy distilled to 6 major schools that covered the 6 areas of philosophical consideration. This is called the Shad Darshana. Shad means 6.
Okay.
Darshana means viewpoint. So this would mean 6 viewpoints. And one of those 6 viewpoints was yoga. And yoga covered a couple of areas that are involved in Western philosophy. But the one we're going to talk about is psychology. So yoga would also be an area of science, but I don't want to go into that today.
But we will
yoga,
another day.
Sure. Well, we only have 45 minutes left here.
That's right. Okay,
for
so
this
psychology.
Moment, we are limited by time and space.
That's right.
So the yogic world had a theory of personality and a theory of how personalities were organized and how theory about how personalities evolved, how they developed if no attention was paid to them, and how they could develop with a process of disciplined personal intervention, I guess you would say, in the unconscious processes.
Okay.
It's the yogic theory of personality is very different from any of the Western that I am aware of, except for possibly the transpersonal psychology. So the thought there was that humans are energy fields. So one of the 6 schools of philosophy was yoga, and this is where we'll go. I'll pick up this line of thought, but I just want to finish this. Each of the schools of philosophy had a great sage who in some cases was the founder and in other cases was the compiler of the wisdom of the discipline. Patanjali is not the founder of the school of yoga, but what he did apparently was take all of the existing material, what we would call literature, but in those days they didn't write things down. What we would call a book was transmitted from a master to a disciple in a very precise method of conveyance where the disciple would memorize the work completely and perfectly so that you could have what we would call a book transmitted from master to disciple who would then become a master and transmit to disciple. This is called disciplic succession, where a book could be transmitted through this disciplic succession with greater precision than it might have going through a written progression.
Okay.
So in any case, Patanjali took the existing material and synthesized it into a book of 196 short statements. These 196 short statements completely synthesizes and summarizes and distills the entire field of yoga. Now, each of these short statements is called a sutra, put together into a book. The entire book is called a sutra. Sutra means thread, and the English word suture comes from the same root. And when it, culturally, when it's the title of a book, it means culturally a single thread unadorned by a single bead. It's telling us that no word is needed to be added and no word can be taken away. This is the pure distillation. Each of the schools of the Shah Darshana has one or two sutras that are the central textbook, and the central textbook of yoga is the Yoga Sutra of the great sage Patanjali.
Okay. And so that, when we talk about the Yoga Sutra in general, are people generally speaking of Patanjali's Yoga Sutra or the what Patanjali wrote down?
There's only one Yoga Sutra. There are a number of powerful books that are important in the yogic tradition, but there's only one Yoga Sutra, and that's Patanjali's. And when you're asking what is yoga, this is where the Yoga Sutra comes in as being particularly important because of the second sutra. This is the statement, Yogash Chittavritti Nirodha, and this defines yoga. And here's where we start to have a cultural problem. Yogash Chittavritti Nirodha, four words, and there are no equivalent terms in English for each of these four words. So in order to define, it's a problem. This is where we have to set aside cultural assumptions and try to put on the cap of another culture. So this is the best translation of that I have heard. Yoga appearance, or the dissolving, of the wave-making action in the energy field we call the mind. So another way to say that would be that yoga is the disappearance of turbulence in this energy field we call the mind. The next statement tells us that when a person is in this state of consciousness, where the mind has come to this state of stillness, then the person knows themselves as they are in reality, their true self, what is called svarupe, true self, that the true self is this silence in the energy field we call the mind.
Okay.
The next sutra tells us that at other times, when we are not in this state of silence, we remain identified with these waves. So this means, Kimberly, that there's a wave in this energy field, this chitta, this local energy field we call Kimberly. So one of the waves is Kimberly, your name.
Yeah.
you identify with that name. I call Kimberly, and you say yes, because you identify with Kimberly.
Yes.
You think you're a woman. You think you're an American woman. You think you're an American woman with certain class structures. Everything that you know about yourself has a characteristic wave action in this energy field we call the mind. Patanjali's statement, yoga, therefore, is a state of consciousness where the mind comes to complete stillness and all these identifications go away, and you know yourself as you are in reality. So what is yoga? The first definition of yoga is a state of consciousness where the energy field gradually lapses into silence. The next definition of yoga is that yoga comprises the practices that are said to bring about this silence in the energy field we call the mind. This is the definition most people have of yoga, the various practices. The third definition of yoga would be yoga is a tradition that perpetuates the practices said to bring about the state of consciousness of yoga. And then the fourth definition is yoga is one of the schools of philosophy, the Shabdarshana. However, when you read books like the Yoga Sutra or other of the great primary texts, the Bhagavad Gita, the Yoga Vaishista, the Upanishads that have references to yoga, they are speaking of yoga as a state of consciousness. This state of consciousness where all vibration comes to stillness, we cannot force that to happen. We can only gradually create circumstances that allow that state of consciousness to happen.
Yeah. And hence the practices. So when we're talking about that, can you elaborate on the different schools of yoga or elaborate on the larger picture to help us understand the practices that melt down the differences in people and their stages of development and so forth?
Yes. By the yogic legends, some say there are 87 schools of yoga, and some say there are 87 million schools of yoga. I'm aware of a few of them. The idea here is to have practices that all different personality types can relate to. So we have commonly known at this point yogic school in the Western world is the Hatha Yoga, and this is the physical practices that people associate with yoga. The purposes of the Hatha Yoga system, the physical practices, are to help develop the body to a place where it can be comfortable, shall we say, we can be comfortable in our own skin. So this is a process, it's a process of stretching muscles, tendons, ligaments, to find areas of characteristic tension and help to relieve them to bring the body to a state of relaxation. Your mind is not going to be relaxed if your body is tense. And so this becomes, for most of us, a very important stage. Other schools of yoga include, for example, kirtan. This would be chanting. People get involved in chanting and can actually, I'm sure many of your listeners, you too as well perhaps, have lost yourself in a song or lost yourself in chanting. And so this is called kirtan yoga. And frankly, it's very often a subset of another yogic form called bhakti yoga, the yoga of devotion. So if you spend time in India, you'll find Indians who are in devotional processes to any number of deities, Krishna being perhaps the best known here. But the devotion that our Christian brothers and sisters have for Jesus is actually a bhakti yoga form. All Christians are yogis, whether they realize it or not. So the devotion to the
okay.
divine form is present here. Now, if kirtan is a part of the devotional process, then the singing of hymns in Christian churches is part of the kirtan yoga. The recitation of prayers moves into another area known as mantra. So another meditation system is the recitation of sacred syllables. And this can be done silently or out loud. And again, the Lord's Prayer and Hail Mary are fine examples of mantra in the Western world. And part
okay.
of this devotion, my Christian friends can lose themselves in bliss with their devotion to Jesus. So when I
yeah.
have been present for this, I realize that I'm in the presence of a fine yogi. So what I'm trying to do is get the definition of yoga far beyond the issue of standing on your head or getting your ankle behind your neck.
Thank you.
Yeah.
While that's fun, yeah. not everybody can do that, and it's a little deeper than that.
And it's not relevant at all. The book
Thank
on
you.
The physical practices, the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, only lists 15 of these physical manipulations that we call asanas, the cultural asanas. There are only 15 of them. The goal is that you should be able to sit silently. In 1968, I had an opportunity to teach yoga in its various forms to a circus college in Illinois, in central Illinois, and they had an actual contortionist, and she was really gorgeous. It was amazing to watch her. She could do anything perfectly, and she was elegant and graceful, and I couldn't see that she had any resistance in her range of motion, in joint range of motion. After the third session, she wanted to talk to me, and she explained to me that the physical practices that she was getting with me were totally different from what she was doing with her contortionist performance.
That makes sense.
She said, it may look a lot alike,
mm-hmm.
but it's totally different. She went on that it was changing her. She said, this has only been three times, and this is changing me. She said, this was what I was looking for when I went into my gymnastics. And she said, I don't know if I can continue to be a performer now, because this is taking me into such a deep place within myself that I don't know if I can do it in public. And we talked about that, and she was able to stay performing. But what I'm trying to get across here is that the physical manipulations of the cultural asanas of Hatha Yoga are not about fitness. They're not about physical beauty. They're not actually really about physical health. And there's nothing wrong with any of those things, Kimberly. Those are all just great. They just don't have...
Yeah.
It's just not about yoga. Yoga is about bringing the mind to stillness and coming into contact with that true self. This self that's referred to in the Old Testament, be still and know that I am God. Yeah.
That, you know, that is a perfect place for us to just take a moment and let's think on this. Let the listeners think on it. We're going to think on it. I'm going to play what is happening for the Tai Chi Symposium so that those that would like to go have an idea of what it's about and when it is. And then when we come back, let's continue from this point forward.
Hi, I'm Restita De Jesus.
And I'm Robert Deal.
We're the founders of the Seika Network on blogtalkradio.com.
And we've got some great events that we'd like to share with you.
On July 6th through the 11th, 2014, the International Tai Chi Chuan Symposium will present an exciting event where five Tai Chi Grandmasters, each representing the traditional Chen, Yang, Wu Hao, Wu, and Sun styles of Tai Chi, will share their knowledge and skills. Tai Chi practitioners from all levels, including beginners, will benefit from this opportunity to learn and practice directly with the Grandmasters. The five masters that will be teaching at this event are Chen Zhenlei, Yang Jun, Zhang Zhenchan, Ma Hailong, and Sun Yongtian. You don't even have to be an experienced Tai Chi practitioner to attend. Whether you're a health promotion planner, healthcare provider, personal trainer, martial artist, physical education instructor, or school administrator, all are welcome to attend. Don't miss this opportunity to train directly under the masters. For more information to register for Directly from the Source, just go to www.taichisymposium.com or you can email info@taichisymposium.com.
Hi, I'm Restita De Jesus.
And I'm Robert De...
Hi, I'm Restita De...
Sorry, having some technical difficulties here. There we go. All right. I really love how everybody is invited to that Tai Chi Symposium. I think that sounds like such an incredible opportunity to get to know other people and what Tai Chi is really all about. So I'm excited. Thank you, Restita De Jesus and Robert Dial, who are founders of the Seika Network, which is the network that we are on. And so coming back to you, Salvatore, I really appreciate that all-inclusive nature of how you get across your message or why you're here or the message of yoga, that there's nothing wrong with exercise. There's nothing wrong with fitness. It's not about wrong or right. It's about understanding what yoga is so that you know what that is, if that's the practice, in fact, that you would like to partake in, and the difference between what that and just physical activity are. I mean, they're both important. One is just quite a bit more vast or larger than the other, whereas fitness may fall under this umbrella of yoga somewhere, and you mentioned the word Vyayama last time we met on the show. Would you like to elaborate more on why is yoga, or why does yoga exist now in America or in the West?
I'll go as far as I can with that question. I think it's a really important one, and we may have to continue it in another show, because it's actually very large.
Yeah.
A case can be made that yoga was the crowning achievement of the Vedic civilization. And that a case can be made, I'm not telling you that this is the truth, an argument can be made that the entire society was designed to help people move into yogic practice.
Wow.
What I said before was that this was an integrated society. Now, I also mentioned that when the British came, this area we now call India and Pakistan was 1,500 princely states and almost as many languages. But the region...
Whoa.
Yeah, it was huge. And India as we know it, is about just a little over 300 years old. It was the Pakistan. Pakistan is only 66 years old. The British took these 1,500 little states and amalgamated them into a political unity for eases of administration. So India is a synthesis. It's manufactured. It's in many ways not real at all, but it was created by the British for their convenience, and they're just not going to go back to the 1,500 little divisions that they were.
Okay.
However, what they have across this area were broad agreements. By the time the British had arrived, the cultures and the societies of the subcontinent had reached a level of development that it had been several hundred years since there had been war on the subcontinent. Even though there were 1,500 of these little states, and some of them were fairly large, one of them, which I find amusing, was the size of a large cow pasture. It was a kingdom with a maharaja, and it was the size of a large cow pasture, and it was respected by all of the countries on every side of it.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. When the British arrived, it had been so long since there had been a civil war or a cross-border war that the militaries of these various states had become ceremonial rather than being functional militaries for aggression. This is what allowed the British to effortlessly conquer India, because the Indians themselves had evolved past physical violence. It didn't.
That is a large statement.
It's a huge statement.
That's a large statement. Yeah.
Now,
wow.
Because of this, the British interpreted they had forgotten how to fight. The military had become ceremonial, but had not been functional, and the British interpreted this as the inferiority of the Indians. The Indians interpreted it the opposite way, that people who engage in physical violence are unevolved barbarians who are inferior to us. I'm not going to get into the issue of who actually is or isn't superior here. What I find interesting here is here's two cultures taking exactly the same social circumstance and giving completely opposite interpretations to it.
Which just supports what you've been talking about the entire show, is understanding cultural differences, language differences that are deep.
Yes. Now, if we go into the Yoga Sutra, one of the most famous of those sutras gives us what is called the 8 means of yoga. These are also called the 8 limbs of yoga, or the 8 steps to yoga, which is a certain kind of a progressive suggestion of how you can aid this energy field that we call the mind coming to silence.
Okay.
The first step, the yamas. The yamas mean command. And sometimes this is interpreted by Westerners as being very much like the 10 commandments. It's a little bit different. So the yamas are 5 statements. The first one is ahimsa. It means without harm. The second is satya, truthfulness. The third is asteya, without theft. The fourth is brahmacharya, which goes through different interpretations. In its more extreme, it's celibacy. In the ashram I work with, it's appropriate sexuality. And the last was a parigraha, that is without greed. Now, these five are not just statements of how you have to live your life to be a good person. These are actual practices. So in your day-to-day life, if somebody disagrees with you and you get angry and you have harsh words, then this gives you an opportunity to observe this energy field you recall to mind going into himsa, going into harm because of the reaction.
Yeah.
The extent which you become angry and violent verbally, mentally, physically, it's not just talking about physical violence. This is talking about at the mental level. Everything comes from the mind.
So you're saying that essentially these are not judgments. This is not about having judgment. This is about having observation of your mind or practicing observation of the mind field.
Beautiful. Yes.
Okay. Okay.
Potentially, the yogic world really doesn't care if you're a very nice person. You go to places with a lot of these sadhu-type yogis, and sometimes they're not very pleasant people, but they're great yogis. The issue here is being without harm.
Yeah.
I would point out here that this is a huge confusion I see in America. We have huge violence here in this country, and we don't want to deal with it, whether my friends who are in the NRA and my friends who are gun controllers do not want to deal with the issue of violence. It's very deep.
Right. Yeah.
Pungli is not saying without swords. He is not saying without spears. He's saying without harm.
Yeah. Bigger than the weapon. Deeper
the
than
the weapon.
The tool
is irrelevant.
Yeah, exactly.
The safest person in the world is a martial arts master, your Tai Chi friends. Your friends in the martial arts are the safest people in the world because they are not violent. If they're true to the
practice,
to the origins of their temple. I was in a Shaolin temple, and the Master Ho explained to me one day, unequivocally, he said, the highest expression of the warrior's art is the avoidance of violence in the first place. So the issues here, by focusing on, in the American case, guns, we're able to avoid the deeper psychological implications of a nation that has mythologized violence. Our nation turns to violence as a first step in our foreign policy, and now regards diplomacy as a sign of weakness, and we wonder why we have murders in the streets. The answer is, on one side, the NRA says, more guns. My gun controller friends say, get rid of the guns. I'm saying, you're both irrelevant. You're missing the point.
Practice without harm.
Without harm.
Yes.
So this is how we can have a nation like India, where guns are basically illegal. Only retired military, police, and sharpshooters and hunters can have guns. No general ownership, and they have a murder rate twice that of America, because there's actually a very deep violence there. Then you can have a country like Switzerland, or let's say Canada. 7 out of 10 houses in Canada have hunting rifles and an incredibly low murder rate because of a whole different cultural milieu around the issues of harm. The issue here is huge. But one of the characteristics of humans, regardless of culture, is a resistance to the ruthless compassion involved in the utter application of the next step in the yamas, which is satya, truthfulness. The first element of truthfulness is to be honest with ourselves.
Yes.
So this is, I'm using this issue, I don't care about guns one way or the other. I'm using it as an example here. So both my NRAers and my gun controllers both have an inherent dishonesty of avoiding the central issues of personal responsibility in a collective of a very violent
and
society.
That's collective. I just want to say that word.
I'm sorry.
I wanted to say the word collective again.
Yeah. We have personal responsibility, and it builds up. So, again, here we have a couple of things. Who are we? When you talk about Svarupa, the true self, there's an ancient aphorism from India, as the prince, so the people. So the leadership gives a role model to the people. Do we live in a country that is ahimsa? Do we live in a country that's satya? Do we live in a country that's asteya? And I say this wherever I teach. This isn't about America. This isn't about India. It's everywhere. We have certain levels of what our anthropologists and psychologists would call social conditioning. Tungshui is dealing with the yamas. It's very deep personal and collective issues of conditioning.
Yeah.
If we take the five yamas and go to the opposite, you take ahimsa, take the ah away, you have himsa, you have harmful. The opposite of satya, dishonesty. The opposite of asteya, thieving, to be a theft, to be in theft. The opposite of brahmacharya, to be sexually dissolute. But take away the ah of the parigraha, you have greed. So here, the implications that I'm getting here are five practices to overcome our tendencies to be violent, thieving, lying, sexually dissolute greedheads.
Well
put. It's not a pretty picture. It's not a pretty picture.
Yeah.
And it's not one, frankly, that many people want to sit down and take personal responsibility. It's, I think it was Bill W. in one of his books on Alcoholics Anonymous who said, it's always more fun to do a searching moral inventory on somebody else.
Certainly.
Yoga.
Yeah.
Yoga, in its very first step, requires ongoing, moment-by-moment, searching moral inventories of ourselves.
Personal responsibility, personal accountability.
Personal accountability. In 1968, I was living in Chicago when the Chicago riots happened during the Vietnam War, and that was during the Democratic Party convention there. And there was a picture on the front page of the Tribune showing a young protester with his fist shaking in the air and his face contorting in anger as he's screaming. I mean, it was of rage.
Uh-huh.
And the caption described a peace protester demanding an end to the war in Vietnam. I used that in classes for many years as an example of the profound personal dishonesty that is so characteristic in all societies.
That's
Here's a young man screaming in rage, give me peace. That's not the way it works.
Yeah. And while we can understand his anger at wanting war to end, this isn't how it's done.
No. Gandhi said it beautifully when he said, be the change you want in the world.
Yeah.
I have to be honest. When I saw that picture of that young man, I trusted him less than I trusted Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson wasn't pretending to be anything other than what he was. Well, maybe he was. Okay. I mean, but...
but at the time, this is what you felt.
At the time, I felt that politicians, by their nature, tend to be dissemblers.
Okay.
This young man was coming out and presenting himself as having an answer to a problem when he was actually part of the continuity of the difficulty. He was not part of breaking the chain of violence.
Thank you for that, because that visual is powerful.
So I can go on to the next step, but the fact is that the energy field we call the mind, we want the vibration to come to stillness. Last week we talked about the four elements of Chittaprasadanam, the pleasant mind. The first one was friendliness. The second one was compassion. The third one was the thoughts. And the fourth one was judgment.
Uh-oh, Salvatore, you're starting to kind of break up.
We know. Is this better?
I think it's pretty good. Yeah, yes, it is better. And can you repeat the four?
Sure, I can. Friendliness, compassion,
yes.
Delight in the success of others, and non-judgment in the face of disagreement. These are antidotes for jealousy, sense of superiority, envy, and judgment itself. The yamas,
yep,
obviously, are antidotes for violence, dishonesty, theft, sexual dissolution and manipulation, and greed. Your mind field is not going to come to full stillness and silence as long as you are jealous and envious and superior and violent and dishonest and greedy. It doesn't matter how flexible your hips are if you cannot be an honest person. So this is the heart of yoga, right there, in that personal day-to-day self-observation and conscious shift. This is where the great change occurs.
So essentially, what we could get from today's show is that just in that first of the eight limbs, the yamas, that in and of itself, that practice is wholeheartedly practicing yoga. I mean, in the sense of we are practicing without harm, we're practicing truthfulness, or noticing when we are not and shifting it.
We're doing our best to be there, and we honestly acknowledge when we fall, and we do our best to correct. And today's practice becomes tomorrow's state of consciousness. So eventually the time comes when we do not have a violent reaction to the external stimulus of the world. Then it becomes a state of consciousness. This is what had happened in India when the British arrived. The entire culture had been practicing ahimsa for so long that they no longer had a military.
Yeah.
I might say
that
the Panchen Lama, one of the great Tibetan leaders, the Panchen Lama, who holds the spiritual equivalent of the Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama is the political head. The Panchen Lama was the spiritual head of Tibetan Buddhism. He's been killed, and the Dalai Lama's had to do both. I digress slightly. The Panchen Lama in 1933 said that the mark of human maturity and resolution of collective mental illness would be marked by the disappearance of the world's military. We're talking here about the first step of the first step of the eight means of yoga.
Yeah.
Now, individuals can, if you and I can resolve the ahimsa, the tendency to harm at the mental, emotional, verbal, physical levels, if we can resolve that in one incarnation, it will be amazing work. And we really don't need to go beyond that today. I'm giving...
I appreciate that. That's a very freeing statement that you just said. And the practice, one of the things I talked about in the last show is that when you practice just that surrender, just without harm to me in my own practice, is when I start to feel those tendencies coming on and I just surrender and let go and just accept and allow what is happening rather than trying to battle it, it's actually freeing. I feel it in every ounce of my being.
Well, you're moving right along, but here's the problem. Society, we're going to just deal with our society for the moment, does not approve of being a bad boy or a bad girl. And if you, so we pretend at some level to be really good with the yamas in our daily life. I'm a good person. I don't hurt people. I don't lie. We suppress all of those impulses. This is the reason people do not like to meditate, because all of this suppressed stuff then is, there are no defense mechanisms. The great German mystic Karl Graf von Durkheim once said, and I'm paraphrasing, I don't have it right in front of me, that the true purpose of meditation is to allow the demons to arise from the subconscious and be faced and conquered, rather than the purpose of meditation being the avoidance of these uncomfortable internal realities. This is why people sit down, find their minds are wandering, and never try it again. Because the suppressed material arises from the subconscious to be seen. This is how sitting practice ties in, to some extent, with the yamas. Because our minds are going to wander, this stuff is going to come up, we have to look at it, then we have to set it aside and go back to our breathing or our mantra or whatever the focus of our meditation is. But the focus of that, it's actually dharana, but bringing the mind to a single point. But all of these distractions that are coming up are unresolved materials in what we call the subconscious. The things we don't want to deal with, the things we deny, the structures we create to look good to ourselves and others.
And so that's one way, I mean, that is what's happening, and a way to approach that when your mind starts to wander and it becomes scary or uncomfortable is to just see it for that. It's just scary and uncomfortable. That doesn't make it what it is, other than these are vibrations happening in the minefield. This is what's happening, and that's it.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's very
unusual
to actually kill a physical body.
Right.
Very few people have insight and meditation that actually kills their body. That's very unusual.
Yes. But, I mean,
but
I could see how for some it's just so uncomfortable.
Well, because of social pressures, many of these elements that Patanjali is directly talking about, because of social pressure, acknowledge them is virtually an existential threat. People really do, at some deeply felt, perhaps inculcate level, that if they feel superior, if they acknowledge the level of internal dishonesty, that they can't survive this. What will mommy say? What will the minister say?
Right.
What will my teacher say? I've been a bad boy, a bad girl. What kind of punishment will come to me if I acknowledge in any way these deep personal, even spiritual shortcomings. This is why the Ahimsa and the Satya are together here. They are very closely linked. You could put Satya first. Without ruthless compassion, in ruthless personal honesty, in this self-observance, it has to come eventually. It doesn't have to come the first time. It develops, this courage develops over time.
Yeah.
I have enormous difficulties sitting with myself. I think it was Proust who said that the biggest problem the Western man has is being able to sit in silence in an empty room by himself. This is why.
Yeah. Certainly, it makes sense to me.
Kimberly, I've given you a full plate.
You really have, and I just want to thank you so much for being on the show again. And so we got through, well, we didn't get through it, but we have introduced and talked about the first of the eight limbs of yoga. And it just goes to show just how deep this practice is and how much there is to discuss and how many questions may arise. I mean, I'm probably barely touching the surface for the listeners. So I want to remind our listeners to contact me at kimtalkradio@gmail.com if they have any questions, concerns, or discussion they want to bring about with us, because we're going to talk again in another, you know, two or three shows. And I guess we'll just go from this point. How does that sound?
Sounds right to me. I'm already thinking about what to deal with in our next shows.
I know, me too. Well, I want, again, to thank you for your time and send you much love. And for the listeners out there, again, if you have questions for Salvatore. And Salvatore, do you want to give your email address directly?
Sure. Salvatore, SalvatoreVatore, at yogasutras.net, YOGASUTRAS, yogasutras.net. Enjoy hearing from you.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you so much, Salvatore. And so as we leave the show today, I would like to invite you to practice being happy, practice love, and the first of the first yamas, ahimsa, without harm. Breathe, be calm. Thank you, and have a wonderful week.
Because I'm happy. Clap along if you.